Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. My guest today is Peter Coyote, a successful movie actor and narrator par excellence of a great many of the nature and environmental TV shows you've seen over the past quarter century, as well as the narrator of all of Ken Burns' great documentaries for the past many years now. But in addition to all that, or rather before all that, he was one of the founders of the counterculture of the 60s. This is the second of a two-part series on the 60s we're doing here on American Variety. Thank you for joining us, Peter.
Thanks, Court. Nice to be here.
And thanks to all of you for joining us. And now that you've tuned in, we'll try to turn you on and hope that you don't drop out. I know that was lame, but I had to say it. Anyway, last week, Peter and I talked about how the 60s counterculture got started and what it was like in different places and across different times during the period that really spanned from, I think, about 1963 to the early 70s. We agreed on that. It isn't time-stamped across the 60s themselves. But this week, we'll pick up the conversation where we left off. I said last week that there are many different ways that you can approach the 60s, and that one of them, almost a cliche, is from the perspective of sex, drugs, and rock and roll. And so we talked a little bit last time about the drug culture, but let's talk about the music this time, Peter. It's always amazed me, going through the 80s and the 90s and beyond, that the music of the 60s remains so visible and current in our culture. I mean, most 20-somethings today listen to the Beatles and the Rolling Stones and Bob Dylan and Jimi Hendrix, The Who, The Doors, The Grateful Dead, and all the top performers of the 60s as if they were current, right? But these are really old guys now if they're not even past time. Each generation seems to rediscover them, but that period is now 50 or more years ago. And when I was their age, music that old would have been from the World War I era in the early 1920s. I mean, it would have been something like Caruso or Al Jolson. I mean, I'd have had zero interest in it. Even music from only 20 years earlier, big band music, was of no interest to me then. But the 60s keep hanging on generation and generation after generation. Maybe it's because they hit with such force. I mean, there were about 78 million baby boomers born between 1946 and 64, and they shifted the culture like no generation ever had. The oldest of them are now in their 70s, but their influence is still felt, for better or worse. They changed everything. So does that amaze you too, Peter, the way it does me?
I guess it doesn't amaze me because I've never stopped listening to it.
Yeah, right.
I mean, I was never fully integrated into the psychedelic musical revolution. I grew up on jazz, bebop, blues, folk music. And what struck me about it at the time was authenticity. And the best of the 60s, guys like the Beatles, guys like Dylan, radiate that authenticity. Then on top of the music, people began developing these kind of cults of personality, which was pretty new. It's more American, more about branding. I mean, I knew a lot of the bands when they were starting out, all those big parties in Golden Gate Park, where the Sons of Champlin and Big Brother and Janis and the Grateful Dead played. They were all organized by the Beatles. And so you'd just go, and there was a local guy in your neighborhood, and they'd show up for the rest of the neighborhood. But when the record companies began handing out $100,000 advances to these bands, it created two tiers of people. It created one tier with a lot of money, and another tier which was working for them, selling them hip clothes and guitar straps and, you know, they're dope. And that was not so helpful to the community. But I think the stuff that survived, survived because it was authentic. And I think there's a lot of, the background of excellence everywhere is mediocrity. Most people are mediocre at what they do, and that includes musicians. But that background is how you identify excellence. And the excellence stays.
Well, there was a period of time when the music industry didn't know how to take over the emerging rock stuff. I mean, and you were there in San Francisco when psychedelic rock was getting going, like with the Jefferson Airplane and the Grateful Dead, and you mentioned Janis Joplin and so many others, that they didn't know how to get a handle on them. So for quite a while, the authentic rock, you know, revolution that was going on tried to resist the commercialization of their music. But in the end, they wear you down, and it becomes something that just happens.
Well, you know, it's hard to be poor.
Yeah, yeah.
And
yeah.
As you get older and as kids come into it, it's hard to be poor. The same thing happened in the 40s with American abstract expression art. At the time, that community was the artists, the poets, the musicians, the dancers. They were all together. Frank O'Hara from the New York Met was championing Allen Ginsberg. And then Nelson Rockefeller decided that abstract expressionism would be the perfect example of American democracy because it had no political content. And so they began giving, they had the Biennale in Venice, and they gave big awards, and they started buying these abstract expressionists, and they took them out of the community, the same way that the rock and rollers were liberated out of the communities by money. I'm not faulting them. I mean, it's hard not to take an opportunity. I certainly took opportunities to get paid as an actor, but you can't do it without realizing that there's something being lost when you do that.
Yeah. I mean, you know, celebrity and fame are very seductive. I mean, along with the money comes, you know, let's be frank, comes women and adulation, and all of those things are like a drug. They're very attractive and hard to say no to, right? So,
yes, exactly.
Did you know, I mean, you were there again in that seminal time in San Francisco when it really, a lot of this was being born. I mean, the concerts that promoter Bill Graham put on at the Fillmore and the Winterland Ballroom, like the Acid Test. I mean, did you go to some of those things?
Well, you need to know that Bill Graham used to be the manager of my theater, the San Francisco Mime Troupe, and was a great friend until he died. And the first rock and roll light shows in San Francisco, the first three, were held as benefits for the Mime Troupe.
Oh, wow.
And we did the second one for Tim Leary to raise money for his defense. And they were so popular that Bill just took out the lease on the Fillmore Theater for himself and, you know, had a Saul on the Road to Damascus experience and became Bill Graham. So, yeah, I knew everybody. I mean, I had a key to Janis Joplin's house till she died. We were, unfortunately, drug partners, but also good friends. And everybody kind of knew everybody.
An early guest on my show, someone I know named Bill Killeen, was Janis Joplin's boyfriend when she came to the University of Texas at Austin.
Uh-huh.
When she was a freshman in college. A little aside there, if you're listening, Bill. Anyway, so in another window into the 60s is through the major events on which the culture turned. And we said in the last show that the media kind of got the 60s wrong by only focusing on those big events. It was partly the way they did focus on them. And there's so many we could talk about. I mean, just pick a few, like university sit-ins against the Vietnam War and lie-ins, they were called, and be-ins, they became. And then, you know, the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom, which was a civil rights thing as well. And then we mentioned the JFK assassination, you know, the arrival of the Beatles in America and the clash at the Selma Pettus Bridge. I mean, we're talking here about things that happened in 63, 64, 65. The Watts Riot in August of 65 was a big deal. The Summer of Love with the human be-in in January 67. Were you there for that and part of that?
Yes, I was there. I mean, you know, from my point of view, the Summer of Love was, again, a marketing branding exercise by the Haight-Ashbury hip merchants. I will say that the be-in was mind-bending to see so many people there in the park. I had sort of poo-pooed the whole Summer of Love idea because we were feeding all these homeless kids and trying to get them shelter, and the police were rousting them off the streets, and the hip merchants, the long-haired merchants, were calling the police to get the runaways cleared out of their doorways so the dentists from, you know, Ohio could come in and buy their products.
I'll be darned.
So it didn't feel so lovey-dovey if you lived there. But to me, the problem is when you talk about the 60s, I mean, you've got to include the 60s was also Vietnam.
Sure.
The 60s was also running cocaine back in the body bags of Vietnam soldiers to sell them in Watts to pay for missiles to be sold to Iran. I mean, the 60s was not just the counterculture. The savings and loan fraud, which wiped out $280 billion worth of private savings. You know, people look at the hipsters as being indulgent. We may have used too much dope, but we didn't create epidemics of dope in the black ghettos to pay for illegal programs that the president wanted to run against Congress's no. We may have been profligate about money and giving it away. We didn't ruin and bankrupt $280 billion worth of American citizens and then do it again in 2008 by relaxing the same banking laws they did. So I have trouble being asked to represent the entire 60s as if the small community of people that were actually trying to make change, despite our bad habits, our indulgences, we're doing the best we could. And yet the background of that was corruption, on vast scales, which no one wants to talk about.
Well, I didn't by any means mean to say that you are the total embodiment of the 60s by any stretch.
I mean, no, I didn't mean it personally, but I meant to address the 60s as the counterculture, which is largely, for most people, a media event. All the things you named, the sexual revolution, the Altamont, the summer of love, these were all media events that were sent out across the United States. Hmm. But under them, there was political corruption, there was illegal, you know, how many people were arrested in the Reagan administration? I think 83 were arrested. So it's just a distraction to look at the kids, drug, sex, and rock and roll when the real crimes were going on in the corridors of power.
Okay, well, I think that's all true. We're broadening it here beyond the counterculture to the entire culture, right? So, but that's all true. But I think there were still some seminal events. And as we said in the first show, the media tended to focus on those events, but they were superficially focusing on it. But I think there were some things, like the Monterey Pop Festival, that really were inflection points in the counterculture among young people, too. I mean,
I agree with you.
Things like Martin Luther King's assassination, for example, was a huge thing in the culture at large, and not just in the counterculture, but, you know, certainly for the minority populations of the U.S. And that was was a major change point, an inflection point in our culture. But
well, if you read deeply about the Martin Luther King assassination, you realize it came at the point after he spoke out about the Vietnam War, while he was planning to bring 500,000 poor people to Washington to set up a tent city on the Pentagon. And there's a fellow named William Pepper who was in charge of the third party that Martin Luther King made with Dr. Jonas Salk. They were going to run for president and vice president. And these people were on J. Edgar Hoover's prayer list. And I will just point out that everybody who is actually Clyde Tolson, who was J. Edgar Hoover's lover, right, had a prayer list. And everybody whose name was listed on it wound up dead. And that included Bobby and Jack Kennedy, Martin Luther King, and a host of people. So that countercultural experience was directly rooted in problems in the majority culture, where people were out of work, inflation was going through the roof, jobs were beginning to be outsourced. That was the beginning of the real downhill slide we're in today.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think you mean to imply that King's assassination was directed by the FBI, but the redneck across the street from the Lorraine Motel who did it was, you know, an extreme racist and so on. But he was moved by some of the same things that put him on Clyde Tolson's prayer list.
I'm not implying it, but William Pepper's book lays out the database for it, and he held a trial in England where they used American juridical rules. All American lawyers and prosecutors, and James Earl Ray was acquitted in 20 minutes by a British jury. Hmm. So you can take your own conclusions. But there were military sniper units in the town at that time. There's all sorts of stuff that is based in fact, that is sourced and footnoted. You know, these things, it's like suggesting that Oswald got on a bus by himself with a rifle wrapped in a paper bag and assassinated the president of the United States. Just defies logic.
Yeah, I know. I mean, in the case of the JFK assassination, it's clearly totally still up in the air, and most sensible people are inclined to think it wasn't just this one lone gunman guy, but
people
I never heard of it.
Don't read about the Martin Luther King assassination, but the same body of information and scholarship exists.
I was just going to say that I had not heard any of that about the King assassination, so I'm sure that the same kind of things exist. I just wasn't aware of it.
Well, we can't keep up with everything, can we? And that's sort of how the bad guys kind of win. There's so much. They give you so many fires to stamp out. You can't keep up with it all.
You know, I mean, another big event, obviously, that seemed like a major inflection point to me. And again, it was a kind of a media event, but it was made into a media event more than it started as one, was Woodstock, you know, and that's, you can hardly talk about the 60s without mentioning Woodstock, right? I didn't go. I started to go. A lot of friends I had went. I was in college, but I didn't have the money to go. I couldn't have afforded the trip from Florida to New York, I guess. But it was, it was a kind of a watershed thing, and it was sort of a turning point, a bit of a downhill turning point to me afterwards. What did you think about that?
I didn't go. I mean, I'd already seen The Summer of Love. So one of the things about the Diggers was we tried to always diminish the distance between the people on stage and the people off stage. Our parties were held on the summer solstice or the midwinter solstice. Huge frames in which everyone was equal. There's something about setting up a stage which is protected and owned territory and putting all these iconic people on the stage to represent the audience. The audience is not making their own music. So, you know, I thought these people were learning what we had learned. They created their own self-service centers, their own hospitals, their own food. Mm-hmm. They made the best of a terrible situation and did it nonviolently. And I thought that was a great lesson to be sent out to the rest of the United States. But I was not going to travel cross country to go hear some music.
Hmm. And sit in the mud while you did it. But anyway, yeah, well, you were, again, a number of years older. You know, I don't mean you're ancient, but you were a number of years older than the 18-year-olds who were there at the time in 1969, right? So that was a difference. They had not participated in the other things because they were children.
Fair enough.
You know, so you mentioned the self-indulgence of the generation in a way, and a word that always occurred to me even back then, you know, 40 years ago, to describe the baby boomers and the counterculture was self-indulgence. I thought it was like there was this feeling that you could and actually should rebel against the complacency and conformity of your parents' generation by getting stoned and getting laid and working as little as possible, all while putting up a show of seeking enlightenment and resisting the evils of capitalism. And so there was some degree of show to it, even if it was unconscious show. Even while I participated in it to some extent, it still seemed to me to be an elaborate excuse for extending your adolescence as far as possible into adulthood and kind of playing and avoiding grown-up responsibility. So what do you think about all that? Do you agree to some extent?
Well, you know, there was a lumberyard in the town where I grew up. They had two rulers. They were famous for it. They had rulers when they were selling lumber, which had smaller inches, so you wound up buying more board feet. And they had rulers when they were buying number that had bigger inches. So that's, you're kind of using the one ruler. Between 1965 and 1975, I lost 18 of my closest friends.
Mm-hmm.
The people I knew were playing for keeps. And we may have had bad habits. We may have been self-medicating. I mentioned PTSD. I mentioned runaways. I mentioned problems. There was a lot of self-medicating. And we didn't have a lot of vocabulary that grew up later about how to resolve conflicts. Like you're living on a commune, and I wake up in the morning, and a guy has cleaned the transmission in the sink, and the sink is a grease pit. Well, there's no revolutionary ideology that you can bring to bear that should demand that the sink be cleaned. I think you can call it show. I mean, I don't know what you call it when people get in their cars and go to football games and get drunk in the outside, you know, the tailgate parties and paint their faces and act woohoo and then go back to corporate America for the rest of the week.
Yeah.
But most of the people that I knew really meant it. And even when we cut our hair and got jobs, the Diggers, for instance, still has a unit of 140 people where we kick in money. We're supporting 12 of our people who are old and indigent. A lot of our kids have become psychologists and nurses and doulas and OBGYN people. So I don't buy that. I mean, yes, in every aspect of human life, there's going to be some certain amount of self-indulgence. But what about the self-indulgence of the people running Washington and the economy who destroyed the unions? Ronald Reagan's first act in office was to fire 11,000
air traffic controllers
and declare war on the unions, and the corporate sector followed him. And if you look from 1973 till today, working people in the United States have not had a raise in real dollars. So is that indulgence that the people in Washington have full insurance, they have armed guards, they have free plane flights? I mean, come on, you're measuring with two different rulers.
Of course it's self-indulgence, and I didn't mean that that was true of everybody, and I certainly didn't mean it was true of the original progenitors of the whole thing, who were very committed people, like yourself and the people you were with and the diggers and so on. We never did describe in this show what the diggers were, but it was a community self-help group that was kind of grassroots and that Peter was one of the founders of. And what I'm talking about is as it went on and became something that involved millions of baby boomer age kids, there was, to varying extents, there was a degree of just outwardness or superficiality to it.
You could say the same thing about Christianity.
Well, yeah, sure, of course.
Okay. Right? It's just a human.
Yeah, okay.
It's just a human downhill slide and slacking of standards.
There you go.
It's not solely directed at the counterculture or kids that wanted to be the counterculture.
So we do agree. Anyway, but I was going to say, you could argue that the self-indulgence eventually led to a lot of the societal decline we see today, the high divorce rate and the dissolution of the nuclear family and the opioid epidemic and pornography.
Whoa, I'm not going to agree to that at all.
Okay.
Let's talk about the loss of jobs as one of the big wreckers of the nuclear family. The fact that people have to have two and three jobs to even survive. I mean, it's not the 60s that engineered the wreckage of American culture. It's American culture that did it. It's a culture based on profit, private property, and me first, as opposed to we. And whatever you want to say about the counterculture, it was very we-oriented, very group-oriented, especially on the communes. And I'm certainly not going to take a rap for the self-indulgence, which has corroded everything from the manufacture of quality goods to collaboration and kindness in American society today. I'm not going there because we didn't have the power to do that. The people who have the power to do that are the ones who are setting social policy. When you live in France, you look around and everybody on the street has voted to take care of you if you get sick. In America, if you fall down, somebody's liable to take your wallet before they call 911.
That's true.
That's as a result of social policy. The hippies could not control that. You couldn't control that. The people we sent to Washington are the ones that sent our jobs away, are the ones that made it legal to charge 30% interest for credit cards, 500% interest for payday loans. I'm just not going for that as being the fault of the counterculture.
Okay. Well, I would say it's a mixed bag of things, but to me, looking at it somewhat more dispassionately than I suspect you do, I think that the elements of the counterculture contributed at a grassroots level to a lot of those things, but let's not get into it.
No, I'll agree. Yeah. I'll agree with you. As long as you make it one of the rivulets feeding into the river and not the river itself.
Oh, sure. Yeah, of course. Yeah. Well, let's talk about some of the good things that came out of the 60s. I would say, like a greater tolerance for personal choices and idiosyncrasies, for one thing. It's not so conformist at all. You know, that was part of what the rebellion was against, was the conformity of, father knows best and so on. But racial equality, even though it's backslid in the last few years, it seems like it definitely took major leaps forward. I mean, somebody like Lyndon Johnson being, the leader of the Great Society, who would have thought, right? Freer speech. I mean, a lot of different things that are positive that came out of the counterculture of the 60s.
So I can give you a quick thumbnail. I think it's fair to say that we lost, we meaning the counterculture, that we lost all the political battles. We didn't end racism. We didn't end imperialism. We didn't end capitalism. We didn't end neoliberalism. We didn't end free market politics. But on a cultural level, we won everything. So the women's movement, the environmental movement, alternative medical practices, acupuncture, homeopathy, naturopathy, alternative spiritual practices, Buddhism, Wicca, Vietnamese Buddhism, Tibetan Buddhism, all of the organic food, slow food, the restaurant businesses, all these cultural changes people have actually adapted into their lives to the degree that farmers in Nebraska are fighting fracking, which is threatening their production of organic food. So on the deep level, even under politics, I think the counterculture was responsible for the major positive cultural changes in the last 50 years.
I would totally agree. You know, look at LGBTQ movement.
Exactly.
You know, another example.
Exactly.
I mean, those things would have been.
And it all comes down to authenticity. Every family had a gay relative somewhere, even if they didn't talk about it, you know, and it's the decency of American people that finally recognize that. I'm waiting for them to recognize that the Equal Rights Amendment has never been signed and that women are still consigned to secondhand citizenship.
Well, I think there have been sea changes in both those areas, and it's moved forward, even though in some cases it's taken major steps back. But that's the way things work in societies and cultures, right?
Yeah, I think that's right. That's what my dad, you know, my dad came to visit me once in the winter of 69. And he, you know, I thought my name was stupid SOB until I was about 20. And he spent a weekend at our commune, reined in, dirt poor, you know, hard scrabble hippies, although we never called ourselves hippies. That was a made up word to infantilize us. But he basically said, you know, when he was leaving, his last words to me were, America's dying of its own internal contradictions, and I'm one of them. He was a big capitalist. He died below broke, but he was a president of a railroad and an oil company and stock market firm. He said, America's dying of its own internal contradictions. You think it's going to take 5 years. It's going to take 50. And I'll tell you that the SOBs who are holding it now will never let it go. They don't care about their children or their grandchildren. They paid their dues. They want to die with their toys. So you better hang out for the long haul. Keep your head down. Take care of your kids and your wife. And don't let them fall on you. There are huge historical forces at work. And that was in 1969.
Well, apart from being so tough on you, he does sound like a man for, at that time, who thought.
No, he was a thoughtful guy. He was a very, very smart guy.
Yeah, well, at the risk of sounding like I'm stroking you, I'll say I can see where you got it.
Anyway. Well, he went to MIT when he was 15, but he didn't understand my mind. I'm a left-hander.
Sure.
He was a right-hander.
There you go.
And our brains work differently, and he didn't understand my skills, and I was quite deficient at his skills. He could multiply five-digit numbers in his head. I could never tell why, when one train was going north and the other was going south, what was the conductor's name? Those word problems and things just fried me, and yet they were his measures of intelligence. So there was a deep misunderstanding there until the end, but those were his last words to me.
Well, your brains work differently, but they both work well, and so I've been happy to have you on. I appreciate you being on American Variety here 2 times in a row, Peter. It's been great.
Thank you so much, Cord. It's been fun.
It has been. Let me mention again, as I did before, that you wrote an autobiography called Sleeping Where I Fall in 1998, and then another memoir called The Rain Man's Third Cure, An Irregular Education in 2015. And I urge people to go buy those and to go to your website at petercoyote.com, where you can read all about Peter's books and movies and other work.
The Rain Man's Third Cure is not exactly a memoir. It's about mentors and teachers.
Okay.
And it's about the discovery of the necessity for wisdom.
Okay, good. I'm going to buy them both. Well, thanks again, and I appreciate you being on, and thanks to all of you for listening. I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.